Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today's episode deals with the defensive side of the game. Last episode was all about the offensive side of the game. And these things are usually prompted by our thousands of members in the 343 coaching education program. The number one problem has always been on the offensive side of the ball. They're like, Gary, you know, we possess very, very well. We have 60% possession or 65% possession, but we can't seem to score goals. So that's what the last episode was all about. But then, of course, there's always the defensive side of the equation as well. It can't be neglected because, as they say, defense wins championships. But there is quite a bit of nuance to it. And so Benny brought it up. How do we deal with training defenders? How important is the defensive side of the game when compared to the offensive side of the game? So coaches, parents, fans, media members, buckle up. We're putting our Sergio Ramos face on and our Sergio Ramos captain's armband on, and we go from there. Per usual, for those of you who are new to the 343 ecosystem, we do not accept sponsors. We sponsor ourselves. And the way we do that is we offer products and services for coaches and for parents. For coaches, you go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium programs for you there. All of it is rooted in the pioneering work of my brother, Brian Kleiben, who created a seismic shift here in the American youth soccer development landscape. And now has taken the game to the professional level. So you get to see and hear his actual training of his actual teams over the course of many years. It is not a scripted program. It is not content that we grab from books or other people's work. No, no, no. It is our own work. It is Brian's own art that you get to witness for yourselves and learn from. So once more, you go to 343coaching.com for that. And parents, we know how critically important you are to the development of your kids. You are just as, if not more important than the coach, than the club you're at, than all the matters of circumstance that play a role. So for you, you go to 343masterclass.com. That is where we codified our decades worth of experience from youth to pros. We've seen the cycles over and over and over again from the ages of 8 years of age up to 18 years of age. And then they graduate and they go on to college and they graduate and go on to being professional players. We have had college players ourselves. We've had professional players ourselves that we've mentored throughout the years. And so we've seen the whole cradle to grave pipeline and the outcomes associated with it all. We've codified it for you at 343masterclass.com. All right, enjoy this episode. Benny Rogers grills me on the defensive side of the equation. Here we go.
Last week, we talked about attacking. I feel like it would only be right to, on the other end, talk about defending. And I've gone through the course, 343 coaching course. You know, I'd noticed that there's in the defending module, there's only two exercises. And my thought process is maybe you're thinking when you have a possession-based team, you know, you're going to be dominating the ball and not have to defend as much. So maybe that's why there wasn't such a big emphasis on defending. But I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on the module, because within the module, there's two exercises. It's the midfield three pressing exercise, and then there's also the defensive pressure. So was that intentional to just only have those two things? Is there more stuff that could potentially be added at a later point? And or maybe is it more suited for the masterclass to have more like individual defending techniques? So maybe we can start there.
Yeah, so much. I'll start with is the first year of the program designed that way by intent, where the defensive side of the equation isn't emphasized as much. Yes, 100%. And we can do a whole episode as from that alone as to why. First and foremost, I'm going to say a general principle. Defending is a lot easier than possessing and attacking. So with that alone, there's an asymmetry built in that coaches and players and clubs need to learn the possession side of the equation, the attacking side of the equation. There's a much higher need for that versus the defending side of the equation. And if I were to kind of quantify, because what I said is a little nebulous, I would say it's a factor of 10 to 1. So it's kind of like learning how to play with the ball is 10 times harder than learning how to play without the ball. basically is what I mean by a 10 to 1 ratio. So that's what the coaches need. That's what everybody needs. On the defending side of the equation, is it important? Of course, it is very important and critically important. And nothing illustrates that more than when a goalkeeper, for instance, makes an amazing save. That's basically the equivalent of you scoring a goal. So of course, it's critical. And the same thing with maybe a sliding tackle, you know, right before a striker is going to hit a ball, all these sorts of things. And that's why you see defenders and the entire team celebrate when there's an amazing defensive play that occurs. So is it important? Of course it is. Now, but what also reminds me of defending is a pretty famous Bielsa quote that it goes, I'm going to totally butcher it, but it's something to the extent of, for defense, all you have to do is run, basically. He's exaggerating, okay, because you need a little bit of structure, right? Like a little bit of discipline, a little bit of technique as to when to maybe, you know, if you're 1v1, when do you dive in and try to steal the ball versus when you delay and not try to do those things? So there's an art and a skill associated with, no doubt. But that's really the rationale, Ben, as to why the program is as lopsided as it is. So you can follow up on that and tell me what, because you told me, you said a lot of things in the intro there that we can dive into.
Yeah. No, Gary, I thought when you said learning to possess the ball and have the ball, I thought you were going to say like that is kind of a form of defending, because, you know, if your opponents don't have the ball, then, you know, what defending do you have to do? But I think a lot of teams now are shifting to this possession-based methodology. And so maybe it's 50-50. Maybe for 50% of the game, your team has the ball, 50% the other team has the ball. So do you focus more on, for coaches, do you focus more on your shape off the ball, or do you focus on, you know, hey, because I know a big principle in the possession-based methodology, and I think Pep was the one who kind of emphasizes like the five-second rule. Like if your team loses the ball within 5 seconds, immediately you need to regain possession. And that was something Brian always instilled with our team. So is it more important to focus on the repress or like the positioning of your team? That way, when you lose the ball, you're able to not sit back, but you're in a good position to win back the ball.
Yeah, I view it as a balance, Benny, but you're absolutely right. And that's why one of the two activities that you mentioned are in the first year of the program is basically how to repress or press the opponent in their half sort of thing. Look, that's the first thing that they have to know how to do, in my opinion, is in that transition moment, go like savages and try to win the ball back immediately or cause so much pressure and disruption that the other team can't ever connect a pass or two or three and get in any sort of rhythm just cause havoc. If the other team breaks out of that quote unquote repress, okay, then you have to transition into the second piece of the puzzle, which is what you just said, is an organized shape, an organized structure, more disciplined approach, more delay tactics, and maybe more trying to force the opponent or waiting for the opponent to make some sort of mistake. And when that moment happens, a trigger occurs and you're basically in repress mode again. So if the opponent makes a bad sort of pass, or somebody has a bad first touch, that should be a trigger for everybody to now full on press all over again. So I see that's kind of like the pattern that I see. And I think that is the subject of the second activity in the first year of the program, Benny, which is essentially, hey, they have the ball, you kind of chill, and you know, how do you react, you know, when they make an action when they make an action. I forget what it is. Is it the three goal exercise sort of thing? I forgot what it is.
That's the first one. It's the midfield pressure exercise with three goals.
So for example, it's simulating if the opponent's center back makes a pass to their left back, then our right winger or right mid or whatever, you know, steps to that, reads it and steps to that. And then the other defensive players kind of are reading the passing lanes and making sure that, you know, the left back is now doesn't have an open passing lane to advance the ball. And so the left back is kind of forced potentially to give it back to the center back. And that's when our central midfielder or striker would step right and press. And then our right mid or right wing or whoever is covering passing lanes. That's the exercise I remember now.
Yeah. And then the second exercise within that module is the offensive pressure. So basically you see I think in this one, it's Brian has like pole set up and he's working with the front four, I believe. So the 9, the 7, the 11, and then the 10. And then he's calling out, you know, which area that he wants them to go and press. Gary, in terms of, so I know I said a lot of teams are playing possession now, and sometimes it's 50-50, but oftentimes you're going to see like a counter-attacking team. So, and we talked about it in the last episode where maybe you're dominating the whole game. You have numbers in there half the whole time. And all it takes is, you know, one or two counterattacks and the other team scores a goal, you lose the game. So what's the best way to prevent the counterattack when you're dominating possession? Does it come down to like the mental ability of your back line to be in a position when your team has the ball? So that I think a quote that I think Brian told me this is like thinking defense while you're on offense. So meaning that if you're a center back, the ball's coming to you and you're pinging it to the left back. As soon as you release the ball, you're already thinking like, all right, if my left back screws up, I have to be able to shift and, you know, cover his ass. I think that was a quote that I got from Brian's. Am I correct in that?
Yeah,
you got that from somebody else.
No, that's exactly right, Benny. I'll repeat it for the audience. Thinking defense while you're on offense. And that goes for every single one of our players. So everybody should be thinking, if we lose the ball right now, what are my defensive responsibilities? And you keep saying that over and over and over again. And it's a very difficult skill to acquire because imagine you're in possession. You also have to be thinking about your responsibilities in possession and how you're going to cause damage to the opponent. But I think over the course of time, what ends up happening is that players, if you emphasize this, that players start gaining a little bit of an instinct and they start seeing where your team can be harmed if we were to lose the ball. And that triggers them to think about that transition more versus, because obviously you don't want to have your player thinking defensive responsibilities if on their particular area of the field, there really isn't much of a threat. You know what I'm saying? Like you really have to be able to identify what is a threat and then how am I going to react defensively in case that threat gets activated. Right. So it's a lot of verbal communication over the course of months and years to the players, but it's also activity-based because the activity that we just finished describing about the midfield press and balance, maintaining balance and shape, you're thinking also, you're not on offense, but you're also thinking like if this person on the other team gets the ball, how am I going to cover the passing lanes? That's a defensive action. And you're actually training it in the activity.
Yeah, it almost becomes like second nature to them. And they almost don't even have to think about it anymore. It's like they're in order to, one, to maintain possession, but two, to put themselves in a good spot in case their team loses the ball. So like you said, Gary, I think over time, you kind of just have that feel as a player on the field. What about, Gary, for the special players on the field that, you know, maybe like, for example, let's use Efra as an example, because he was always playing a couple of years up. He wasn't the biggest. He wasn't the fastest. You know, he was slow on the ball, but obviously his offensive qualities were huge, you know? So what would the conversations be like with Efra before the game in terms of like how he needed to defend? And I think, you know, I know we always use Messi, but people always say like, oh, Messi doesn't defend or Messi's lazy on the field, but it's just completely like twisted, you know? So what were those conversations like with that effort type player?
Well, it's interesting you bring up Messi because as soon as you started proposing the question regarding Efra, that's where my head went because Efra is that type of player and he was such an outrageous outlier at those youth levels, playing 2 years up and dominating all the opposition. Again, for the audience's sake, at the pinnacle, absolute peak of youth soccer, the very, very toppity top, we weren't playing some sort of mid-tier opponent or mid-tier leagues or mid-tier competition or tournaments. No, it was the absolute pinnacle of the game. The kid was playing 2 years up, and he was the most deadly, dangerous, intelligent, technical player all game, every game. And so you want a player like that to be free. Kind of like Messi, right? And if folks, you know, roll their eyes, think about those particular folks who may be rolling their eyes, they're usually the ones who are also opposing so much of our philosophy, in particular, like, oh, the players should be free to dribble and do what they want. And, you know, they should, that's how they express their creativity. So here's an example where I'm telling you guys exactly what you are proposing, that the players should be free, you know, and they should do whatever they want and they should express their creativity. That is the sort of liberty in general, not always in general, that EFRA was afforded, you know, do your thing. You know, cause your damage. We have Charlie behind you. We have Leah. We have all these players who are going to basically cover for you, even though we wouldn't tell him those sorts of things, of course, right? Because we want him defending too. But that was kind of like the coaching and the technical staff philosophy. It's like he needs to be liberated from that mental load, if you will, defensive mental load. Would we have him pressing and running like a madman? Absolutely also. And would we scream, you know, if he wasn't repressing? Let's say he lost the ball there in the moment, he better go and repress immediately. He better be the first one most pissed off to go and do it. But let's be real, Benny. He would do half of what the other guys would do, and we would let it slide.
Right. So if you do have that special type of player, like you kind of want to create, not to say like, hey, you know, effort, you don't have to defend, but you kind of know that maybe you are defending with 10 as a team. And so you kind of plan for that and train that with the other players as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not saying, and I think it's a case by case situation, because in my opinion, Efra's demeanor was an inclination was that of a lazy player. And maybe it was just because of he had so much talent that he became lazy. He's a lazy guy, which is bad. But there are other ultra talented players who aren't necessarily lazy. And so you have to pick and choose whose buttons to push. Because I think, for example, if we push too hard on Efra, he would shut off and turn, you know what I mean? He would shut off and we wouldn't be able to get the best out of him. And we wouldn't be able to get the best out of his development also. I think it would have been against his best interest if we pushed hard, if that makes sense. Versus another player who we see that internally he does have that fire whereby you won't turn him off and ruin him. You could push that kid hard even though he's being lazy. You see what I'm saying? It's kind of like it would be detrimental to the player himself if we were riding Efra, but it would not be detrimental to, I don't know, who's another, you know, Alex Mendez, super talented player, technical, incredible. He wouldn't be turned off if we were to ride him.
No, that makes sense, Gary. What about a player that has incredible defensive qualities, you know, fast, extremely good on the tackle, but on the ball? I mean, there's probably a player on the national team that you're thinking of. On the ball, though, they're, you know, not the best first touch, the distribution, shocking, constant turnovers. Do those type of bruiser players, like, can they fit within a possession-based team? Or should the coach be looking for somebody else?
I think it depends on what level you're at, Ben. I think every player can fit into a possession-based team. It's not the optimal player, obviously. You know, you want the player with the technical and tactical and soccer IQ chops, of course. But if you have a player that doesn't really have those things at a very good level, they could also fit into a possession-based team if your other players are quite good, if your opponents and your competition level isn't all that great. You see what I'm saying? If you as a coach are very good at the possession-based identity, philosophy, style, training methodology, because then you can reorient the whole team to make it work, you know, with that one weak link or two weak links. So there's all these ifs associated with your statement. Now, if the team or that player happens to graduate to a next higher level with higher degrees of opponents, that's not going to work out too well.
So at the youth ages, you can get away with it more, right? Because
Totally. Right. And I should emphasize, because the coaches always try to, everybody always tries to hold on to this one escape hatch that they try to use. It's like, oh, if my players aren't good, we can't do this. Nonsense. Like you said, Benny, if you're at the youth level, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds. And frankly, we said a million times, if you're even operating at a very low level, where you're like recreational type level, you can absolutely build and successfully have a possession-based team. Again, it all comes down to how much time and space there is at the particular level that you compete at. So if your opponents suck and you're playing very low level, your players are going to have a lot of time and space versus at a higher level. And if you know how to train this methodology, you can exploit and have even more time and space at your low level. So it's 100%. Your shockingly poor technical player will receive a pass and it'll hit off his shin and bounce up 3 feet into the air. And that kills 2 seconds of time before he can settle it again, once again. And he needs 3 touches to actually settle it. Well, at the lowest of levels, and if you're training them right, that kid is still going to be able to execute what you want him to execute.
Yeah, Gary, just a quick example of that. About 2 months ago, I had this kid come out and try out for the team. And again, I took over the scene. We're at the lowest level, basically. But this kid that came out, and these are 10-year-old boys. This kid had never stepped on a soccer field before, never probably even kicked a ball. You know, his first practice, he had no idea what he was doing. And obviously in my sessions, you know, it's rondos every single day and possession-based activities. And now, Gary, 2 months later, like, you throw him in a rondo and he's keeping the ball. You know, he's implementing all the concepts. He's confident on the ball now. And like you said, like in this game this past weekend, you know, obviously the opponent is shocking as well. So this kid has like acres of space, but this kid's able to now like complete passes, make the right decision. Last week he scored a goal, which is like so shocking to the other parents. So it was badass. And I think the lower level that you start with, you know, like as you always say, the more improvement that you're going to see on the team.
Yeah, I know we're supposed to be talking about defense. That's what you want, but we can go down this, pull on this thread a little bit longer. There's pros and cons to everything. And so let's write on your example really quick. What ends up happening time and time again, I've seen it so many times, is that the parent starts thinking, oh, the kid is really good, right? And then they start having all these crazy expectations about the kid. Because look, the kid is a great player. He's like Iniesta or Xavi. He receives the ball. He dishes. He has 90% pass completion rate or 95% pass completion rate. He never loses it. And they start extrapolating to get, for people to get the idea. And they start getting upset because the youth national team doesn't call them, or ID camps don't call them, or you know what I mean? Like if it takes them down this path where they don't understand that it's the system that makes that particular player or enables that particular player to look good and be successful. You with me? Because yep. If you put that same player at the next rung of the ladder, the next higher level, all of a sudden they're absolutely shocking, Ben. And 100%. Hey, I just wanted to say that I'm not throwing shade here. It's just simply a matter of fact, right? That context is so important. And could that player end up being, how old was he, Benny? Did you say? 10. Could that player end up being something great or by the time they're 18? That's 8 years in the future. Of course, it's possible. Absolutely, it's possible. I'm just saying, chill. Relax. Don't think you're something that you're actually not.
Okay. I can't tell you how many like phenomenal players I've had on my teams, and the parents, they're like, oh, you know, we want to play at a higher level. And then you hear a year later, like this kid is absolutely like shocking on the team because one, he never gets the ball and his team is just launching it forward every time. So now he's not on the ball as much. And you hear from other parents like, oh, you should see this kid. He's regressing and they should have never left. So it's just funny, Gary. People always think the grass is greener on the other side.
No, of course. They just lack context, Ben, because they haven't seen enough. They haven't experienced enough. And they, you know, understandably aren't practitioners themselves and in the weeds for decades. And it's not just the technical and tactical, which was this example. How much have we spoken about the mental side of the equation or the physical side of the equation? So you could be a technical tactical master, you know, but there's other two components to be considered in here: the mentality side of the equation, and the physical side or the psychological. All those sorts of things end up mattering the higher and higher and higher level you go. So if you think that you are capable of playing in USL, or you're capable of playing in MLS, or you're capable of playing Liga MX. I'm going up the rungs of the ladder, right? Or you're capable of playing in Europe, or you're capable of playing in Europa League, or you're capable of playing in the Champions League. You know, those are all different stages, dude. Like, the brain and the physical are just as important.
Yeah, for sure. No, I'm glad that you brought up the mental, because that was the next thread that I wanted to pull on. At the younger ages, Gary, I've always been taught, like, okay, if the other team's goalie has the ball, like, the first defender on the field is the nine, or the first line of defense is the nine and the two wingers. But I think a lot of kids, it's like, oh, coach, I want to play forward, or I want to play wingers. And especially if they're, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, you put them in those spots and they think that it's only about scoring goals. So how do you instill in everybody on the team, like, hey, everybody on this team is a defender. How do you get them to have that mentality of, when we don't have the ball, you need to be hungry to go win it? Is a big part of it, like, within the rondos, like, because I know often Brian would emphasize, hey, if you're in the middle of the rondo, like, you should be flying, working your ass off to win the ball. And if you're just jogging, being lazy, you know, your teammates on the outside aren't going to get better. But does that also kind of instill that defensive quality? Like, hey, when I don't have the ball, I'd be hungry to go win it back.
Yeah, I think it needs to be incorporated in all the training exercises. It's trying to install that pride on the defensive side of the equation. So and make it a game, make it challenging. You know, who is the best guy, you know, when you're in the middle of a rondo, or you're the defensive team in the middle of a rondo, to just not get owned by the people in possession. And it takes time, Ben. It takes time. It takes weeks, months, years to instill that culture. That's why culture is so important, because if you have a particular team culture, that is akin to saying that there's peer pressure on every individual to subscribe to the team culture, and you can't not do it. If you're a lazy sack, and clearly that goes against the team established team culture, all the players themselves are going to get on you for being a lazy sack. And so you as a human being don't want to be ostracized. You want to be part of the group, part of the collective. So it's a cultural thing, Ben. So you have to start at some point and then do it for years, dude. And also, I think it's important to give examples. That's why the professional game is so important. It reminds me of Julian Alvarez, the Argentine national team number 9. He goes to the World Cup, you know, the starter, the most clearly the biggest goal scorer and the most prestige and pedigree guy was Lautaro Martinez, who was the captain of Inter Milan, the captain, okay? And I think he was even Pichichi of Serie A, you know, leading up to this sort of stuff. So he was the global international success story. And Julian Alvarez was, I think, at the time, just bench warmer to Haaland in Man City and would get sparing minutes. But come time, the Argentine World Cup, you know, Julian Alvarez becomes the starter, is the starter over Lautaro. And the reason is because of what you just said. Julian Alvarez presses the opponent like a madman. He will run from one touchline to the other to press and press the keeper. And if the keeper just dishes, gets out of his press, he won't stop there. He'll go and press the center mid or the whoever who just got the ball. But Lautaro doesn't do that. And so guess who played? And Lautaro was pissed off. I have to find it. There was a former Mexican national team player who kind of gave this analysis too. I forget if it's... I don't think it was Benjamin Galindo. I'm going to have to look it up. But he had the same exact opinion that I had. I just saw it just a few weeks ago. He's like, hey, look, the guy who's captain on Inter Milan, nothing. You're on the bench.
I know one thing that Brian emphasizes a lot is like pressing triggers. And I've also heard or seen within the 7v7 course, I know John emphasizes like, hey, these are the pressing triggers to be looking for. What are the biggest ones that Brian would preach? And that's part of the philosophy, is that, you know, when the players received with their weak foot or taking a bad touch on the ball, what were the pressing triggers? Because obviously you don't want your team just like the other team's building out and you just have four or five guys running to the same area and just overload one area and then the other team swings it and goes out to the other side. So what, and the other thing too is like, would you guys try and emphasize movement to where the other team was forced to build out to one side? Like you identify their weak player and then you have players slide, and would that happen as well in the training environment? Or is that more of like an in-game adjustment?
Yeah, all those things, Benny, all of the above. So obviously the repress is the first trigger. We lose the ball. That's trigger number one that you go like crazy and try to get it back. Trigger number two could be if a player, the opponent player receives the ball with their back to your goal, you know, so basically they're not facing you. They're facing their own defensive side of the field. So go and press them. Another trigger is a bad first touch, you know, go and press. Another trigger could be if there's a long ball, you know, switching the point of the attack sort of thing. That usually, I mean, this was more rare, right? And it depends on the level. That's usually harder for the opponent to control, right? When they have a 40-yard switching of the field or long ball or something like that. So when you see that happening, oh, let's go press the kid that's going to try to settle this ball. Like you already know the chances of a great first touch are almost zero. And then there's the planned ones that you mentioned, Ben. So, you know, sometimes we would scout the opponent and you know that they're left center back or their left back is bad and they try, you know, so let's, and or conversely, or actually more common is their, maybe their right center back and their right back are very good players. That's usually the situation. You identify who are the very good players on the back line. And so you by design try to cut off those passing lanes and don't let them receive so that they're forced to play to their weaker players, maybe the left center back and the left back. And so when that happens, let's go press those guys who aren't as good or might be shocking. Yeah. And that would obviously be trained and not just spoken about, because if you just speak about it, Benny, especially if you don't have that intelligent of a player, you know what I mean? If you just talk about it, it's not going to work because players just forget, they're in the moment, and you need coordination to be able to execute this. So you have to actually train it and kind of show them, hey, when the keeper has the ball, these are your responsibilities. This is how you're going to block off the keeper from giving it to the good players on their team.
Right. 100%. I know we've talked about kind of defending as a whole, meaning all 11 players on the field. But if we take a spotlight and just focus kind of on the back line and maybe the six as well, you know, how do you train them to be a unit? Because I feel like when I watch the highest level teams in the world and you look at their back line, I mean, it literally looks like one organism moving in sync together, stepping at the same time, dropping at the same time, you know, that when they shift their bodies, everybody's shifting. Obviously, you're not going to train a 7-year-old team to be doing that, you know, but as they get a little bit older, how can they start to do that? I know one thing that you'll probably say is, you know, training without the ball. And I think it was maybe Bielsa that I heard this from, where he would actually like separate the training. So like one day he would take the back line and the six and just work with them only, and then maybe the next day he works with, you know, the front four or the front five. Would you recommend that for coaches if they have the time, or is it like everybody has to be together so that everybody can know what's going on?
No, it's ideal, Benny, if you can segregate it like how you said. And I know most youth coaches in particular here in this country don't have that time or that field space or that flexibility where they say, hey, Monday, Wednesdays of this particular week, I'm working with the offensive guys in the midfield. And then Tuesday, Thursdays, I'm doing the defensive work. So if we eliminate that from the equation, then you can still kind of partition it in your training session. But it kind of is dependent on whether you have help or not. So if you have an assistant coach, brilliant. Done, you know, have the assistant go with the offensive guys and you go with the back, the, you know, the keeper, and the back five, right? The four in the back and the six, and you work those exercises. Or if you establish a really good culture, maybe you can, and you don't have an assistant coach, maybe you can get, say, the offensive guys doing Rondo exercise, 4v1, you know, go and do 4v1 over here, or go and do some finishing activities, or I don't know. That's a lot more complicated, because we know youth players are not very disciplined at all. Even if you have a great team culture, they'll start effing around. But that's the worst case scenario. And then you take the back five or back six and you work the defensive side of the equation. So I don't know, from a structural perspective, that's what you do. If you're very young, you could also just say, hey, the offensive guys are also going to do the defensive work too. Mm-hmm. And it goes to, you know, a lot of these folks who are well-intentioned but misguided at times, that, oh, every player should play every position and, you know, rotate, you know, everybody should get a taste of everything. Okay, well, here's an opportunity where you can be like, oh, okay, that's a good idea. You know, my striker is going to be a center back also in this activity, and my winger is going to be a right back and a left back. And you do it with both groups and you rotate them. You obviously don't mix the groups together because you want that coordination that you were just saying. So you get the actual back four line and you work with them. And then you get the other four who aren't actually defenders and you work with them as well. It gives them a degree of appreciation for their colleagues also if you do that. And the same thing with the finishing activities. If you don't have an assistant coach, if you can't partition, have the center back be part of the finishing activities too. And then they gain an appreciation of how hard it is to actually get on the end of a cross.
Yeah. At the younger ages, Gary, is it better to do the backline movement like unopposed, or is it better to have like, right, I don't know, maybe three forwards or like a nine or two wingers, right, and then they pass the ball and then everybody shifts? Or I know recently you also posted on X, I think it was Enrique with PSG, and it's like 11v0, but I know that was more like movement with the ball. But in terms of defending, is it better to just do it unopposed, or, yeah, or is I it like a hybrid?
Yeah, I feel like we need to have an entire episode of that post that I made, but let's go pull on this string. Okay, and we should absolutely inject the actual post, the X post that I made, and the video of Luis Enrique also. Unopposed is king, Benny. Absolute king. So that is you, where you start. You always start with unopposed. Now, always is a powerful word. So if you want to start with having pressure be applied to your team, even though you've never even trained your team to do building out of the back or defensive, whatever the heck it is, you want to throw in pressure? Fine. Guess what's going to happen? It's going to be a disaster. Nobody's going to learn jack shit. Okay. No matter what anybody tells you out there in the world, they are lying, or they are hiding, or they're delusional. Okay. Or they've fallen down they're stuck in this pit so deep in their philosophy for 5, 10, 15 years that they can't admit that they're wrong, right? And then change things. Because I'm telling you, if you have not trained your players, your team, the orchestration of, say, a build out, or the orchestration of how to maintain defensive shape and be smart about it, or the orchestration of offensive patterns, if you have not done any of that and you throw in pressure from day one, nobody's going to learn anything. So that said, the foundational thing is unopposed, Ben. You do it unopposed. And that way, all the players and the coach themselves can acquire the skills involved in doing the actual activity first and foremost, okay, to a base level of understanding. Then once they have a base level of understanding, that's a judgment call, you throw in, say, one player to apply pressure, for instance, or be the attacking guy. I don't know what activity you're referring to, Benny. You throw in one player. So maybe it's one pressing player and four players in possession. And then you throw in two if they master that one. Then you throw in three, you know, when they master that one. Then you throw in full pressure. You do not do pressure without some base level of understanding, some base level of technical competence. But we're talking defensive, right? I was kind of illustrating the point of in possession, right? Because I was talking about in possession, do it unopposed. But even from a defensive responsibility sort of thing, I mean, in a defensive responsibility sort of thing, you kind of have to simulate an opponent who has the ball. So you have to have an opponent participate. Right. So for example, you can start very simple. If you have the back line of four and you want to say, teach them how to step their lines, or, you know, backpedaling, go back in a more defensive or containment posture, you can just use your six and have your six act as an opponent. And so when that opponent has the ball and is facing your defensive line, have your defensive line backpedal. Yeah. And then when that opponent turns their back to you and is going back towards their defensive line, you step your lines. So you just orchestrate that sort of movement back and forth. Very basic, very fundamental. And then you build from there.
What are the qualities, Gary, of the best defenders that you guys ever had within your teams? And another key thing that will be important to bring up is the communication of defenders, especially at the younger ages now. This is a whole another episode, but, you know, kids aren't very socially interactive and they struggle to communicate with their teammates. But I think as a center back or even a goalie, like when you have the vision of the entire field in front of you, it's so important to be communicating with your six, with your eight and 10. I mean, you have the whole picture in front of you. So obviously you need a center back that's going to be vocal and help the team. But more than that, Gary, what are some of the best qualities that you guys recognize in players and those are the players that you guys went after?
Yeah, well, I think you already nailed the most important one. Yeah. And in particular, it's the most important one, the higher the level you go and the older the age group is communication. Because defense is a team sport also. Yeah, there are 1v1 actions in the moment or whatever, but the most effective defenses are the ones that are organized. And so how do you get organized? Well, you need communication. And sometimes that's nonverbal communication, which is what is trained in many instances, like how does the back four behave and how do they move and how do they shift and how do all that sort of stuff can be trained. And so the players don't really need to have communication all that much unless somebody is not doing their job. But the game is very fluid, Benny, you know, and the opponent is always going to give you different looks that you may not always be able to train repeatedly. And so you need maybe a center back or a goalkeeper or whoever it is who is a captain or the captain of the ship, first and foremost, and the general, and is kind of orchestrating. Literally, you are the conductor of the orchestra and you have three or four guys in your band and you're telling them what to do at all times, and in particular when there's danger. This is a good, I don't know if we can inject it on a copyright stuff or whatever, but there's a beautiful illustration of during COVID, I think Holland was playing, I forgot who they were playing, but the camera was focused on Virgil van Dijk for a whole 30 seconds or something. Yeah. You know which one I'm talking about, right?
And empty stadium, so you can hear him.
Yeah, and he's just nonstop barking orders to different players at different times and just conducting the orchestra, the whole thing, man. It's really cool to see. So Benny, man, that's number one. And from our experience, we've had those sorts of players throughout our teams. And we look for those sorts of players because it's hugely valuable. Like for instance, we will compromise some degree of talent, on the ball talent, for instance, for somebody who is an amazing general. That's how important it is. On the talent and skill side of the equation, I mean, it's position specific. This is what the master class is all about. It's like, what are the great qualities of an outside back? What are the great qualities of a center back? You know, you have to be able to be good technically to split lines and filter balls on the ground at different ranges. You have to have, you know, from a defensive perspective, you have to know maybe how to do defensive headers. And that's not as straightforward as people seem to think, you know? So for an example, one very interesting subtlety, say for a center back, if your team is caught kind of out of position in one way or another, and you have the opportunity to head the ball and your team is not organized, what you want to do, or a great move, is to head the ball as high up in the air as you can, because then that buys your team an extra second or 2 seconds. And that's plenty of time for them to actually get back and set in a good, solid defensive shape. Versus if your defensive header is on the ground, you know, or whatever, your team is still discombobulated and chaos ensues. So that is an incredible skill, When you see that in a defensive player at the youth level or the pro level, and you see, understand the context, you're like, that's a smart man right there. You know what I mean? So there's all these little subtleties. The others are, you know, when to try to step in front of a pass. That's, you know what I mean? Or when it's the, so say an offensive player that you're marking is going to receive a pass on the ground. When do you decide to try to step in front of that pass and intercept it versus when you just stay on the guy's back, you know, and try to nudge him versus when you, you know, do something else entirely. When you foul him, when do you, because sometimes you just want to foul the guy and just stop the play. So if you're in the opponent's offensive half and then you're marking a guy and there's nothing behind you, if he beats you, he's one-on-one with the keeper, for instance. So in that instance, if he's going to receive a pass, maybe just foul the guy. A ticky-tacky foul, nothing flagrant so you don't get carded or anything. Just foul the guy. You stop the play. Your entire team gets back on defense. So I don't know, Ben. We can go on and on and on with all these sorts of things. But notice that the things that I just described are not as difficult. I mean, they're tough, but not as difficult as learning the skill and the technique of in possession. Right. So that is why in possession training is so much more important and needs to be allocated so much more time, energy, and effort into than the defensive side.
Yeah, Gary. Like you said, so many little subtleties. A clip that comes to mind to me is, and I'm sure you've seen it too, is World Cup final, Argentina, France. I think it was probably, I don't know if it was in regulation or at the end of overtime, but it was like a France served a ball in the box, and I don't remember which defender it was, but the ball was bouncing awkwardly and this guy kind of like fell to his body and this will like pass the ball with his knee to the goalie, like incredible IQ play. And there's so many little moments like that. I think being a defender is not just the physical aspect of it, but like you mentioned, it's so many little like mental decisions that you have to make, and you kind of just have to be a smart player. But the other thing too to mention is, obviously, especially if you're in a possession-based team and you're a center back or you're a goalie or you're an outside back, you have to be like 100% focused on executing your passes and decisions, because if you're a center back and you lose the ball, I mean, the other team's almost guaranteed to score a goal. If you're a nine and you're up top and you fuck up, like, okay, at least you have 10 players behind you. So that's what makes it even more difficult to be a center back or an outside back. It's like, not only do you have to execute defensively, but on the ball in possession, like, you can't fuck up, dude.
100%. So much more pressure because everybody's looking to you as the reason for the other team scoring or the reason that the team lost. And the keeper is the worst of them all. I don't know how those guys handle it, dude. I've said so many times, and I've received messages so many times over the years. Hey, Gary, my kid's a keeper. What should I do? And, you know, looking for advice or help or whatever. And I tell them straight up, I don't know jack squat about goalkeeping. I can't help you there. I've never been a goalkeeper. I've never trained goalkeepers. I don't know the details associated with it. You know, how to lean on one foot versus the other foot, which hand when you're diving should actually be making the save. Should it be your left hand? Should it be your right hand? And under what circumstances? Like, no clue, Benny. Or I'm sure there's all kinds of subtleties associated with trying to manipulate the opponent as well. So if the opponent is going to, you know, is coming one-on-one or is going to shoot, maybe you're doing stuff intentionally to change the opponent's mind of where he's going to try to shoot and score. Like, who knows, Ben? But yeah. To your point, the defensive line has to be very, very solid in their technical execution of things, for sure.
I agree. It's funny that I know you always say that about the goalies, but I can remember as a kid, like, I mean, Gary, how many times did Brian's teams go to PKs, dude? But back in the day, this rule about the goalie, like, jumping forward before the save, I remember, like, you would always tell the goalies, like, hey, take a fake step to the left forward first and then go to the right. Sure enough, they save it every time. And, like, that was legal back then, though. Now you can't get away with that.
No, but that was also, so I was able to get away with some advice at times because it's low-level stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
So with the keeper, like, that's just low level things. I don't know. I'm going to shut up because I don't know dick. Goalkeeping.
This topic also came up in our last discussion on attacking, but you mentioned it in your examples is the heading aspect and winning aerial duels. And I know we mentioned like this whole thing of, you know, the kids can't even header until they're, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old. So there's a huge deficit that they have for between like the ages of 13 to, I would say 16, to where they're absolutely shocking. So I think that's another huge quality. And I think people have the misconception that if you want to be a center back, you have to be 6 feet tall or you have to be, you know, this amount of weight. I mean, look at Lisandro Martinez, Argentina. I mean, this fool's a midget and still one of the best center backs in the world. So I don't think it's about your height. I think it's about your mentality, your positioning, you know, your IQ in those moments to be, I mean, that fool still wins a lot of headers, dude. And even like my center back in high school, he was, I don't know, like 5'5". This fool would win every single header in the air just because he was so good at positioning his body, or even like the ball would get launched to his area and he'll just give his little, or he'll give his attacker like a little nudge and then he'll make his jump. So there's just little intricacies that go a long way in defending.
Totally, Ben, totally. There's a long list of players who were not 6'3" center backs and had remarkable professional and international claim. You know, I don't remember how tall Fabio Cannavaro was for Italy.
I'll look it up.
Who was kind of in contention for winning Ballon d'Oro as well. And I don't think he's very tall at all. I'm sure he's under 6'9". Small player. Medel from Chile, also midget. Maybe you can look him up too. He's 5'7" or 5'5". I have no idea. You already mentioned Lisandro Martinez for those folks who are a little bit more contemporary. Mascherano, when he would be played at center back, also. Mascherano is a little midget. The list is long. Does it Medel, help?
Medel is 5'7", dude. That's insane.
Yeah, dude. I mean, does it help if you are, you know, 6'1" or 6'3"? I mean, yes, probably statistically speaking, but I don't know. Yeah. We've had it all. Most of our center backs were a little bit on the tall side. I would say that's probably true. But especially with your point of not being able to head the ball when you're a little kid here in the States, maybe a whole new crop of center backs will develop who are not tall.
100%. I think the big thing is the timing, Gary, and they don't read the ball well. Something that I learned from Danny Califf, former national team player, is he told me, like, instead of standing straight when the ball's coming to you, like, do the running backwards first. That way you can go and attack the ball. Because a lot of people, like, the ball gets in behind and they're kind of a statue. And then when the ball gets near their head, they try to, like, back up and then head it. And then they're, like, completely off balance. He's like, run backwards first. You see the ball coming down. Then you go and attack the ball and you'll be fucking launching the ball out of the air. And, you know, so that's something I teach my players. And yeah, it works perfectly.
But totally. And vertical leap versus a running jump too. So right, you can get as high.
100%. But yeah, the time and the timing, it takes practice and it takes, you know, constant repetition to get these things right. It's not just going to be like the ball's coming all of a sudden. Hey, guess what, kids? Now you can head the ball. They're not just going to fucking know how to do it. You have to like teach them and they have to get experience at it. No,
totally. See how much there is to do, Ben? It's just impossible.
Yeah, crazy.
It's just impossible, dude. If you're in a traditional 2 training day a week youth situation here in the States, to think that alone is going to develop your player to their potential is ridiculous. It is impossible, Ben. Look at all the stuff that we just even talked about in this episode, which is non-exhaustive at all. At all. Look at all the little things, all the details from team organization, from individual 1v1 actions to the subtleties that you just discussed, Ben. How on earth is one coach training a team of 18 players or 20 players or 15 or whatever the number is two times a week going to do this.
There's just no chance, dude. We could go on for another 5 hours about this stuff, but I think that's another important thing, Gary. I know you mentioned in the episode it's having an assistant coach, if it's possible. I think somebody commented like, hey, can you have an episode on what you look for in assistant coaches and, you know, what is the role of assistant coach? So maybe in the future that could be a good episode.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Who's your top center back of all time? Well, maybe the top center back that's still playing right now.
Center back of all time.
And your outside back.
Yeah, I want to say, you know, Paolo Maldini for center back. The reason I hesitate, though, is that, let's be honest, I was very young during his time. And so the eyes through which I would see things back then are clearly not as good and sophisticated and as they are now. But I'll just stick with him. Outside back is no brainer for me. It's Roberto Carlos and Cafu. Again, I could say the same exact thing that I just said about Maldini, and I might be biased because it was my young days and, you know, seeing these Brazilians doing incredible things, and that maybe that leaves an impression on me that's longer lasting and much more potent and maybe even flawed. Whereas if I were to maybe somehow do an objective comparison with Marcelo or Dani Alves or the more modern sort of guys, maybe I would change my mind, but I'm sorry, I'm sticking with those guys. Cafu and Roberto Carlos, just outrageous guys. They had all the tools. They had all the defensive tools that we just discussed and the offensive tools. A classic Brazilian outside back offensive tools at their disposal were just outrageous. The physical side of the equation, outrageous. They were super fast. They had stamina up the yin yang, going up and down the sidelines, no problem. Their finishing capabilities, their technical capacity, their mental fortitude. They were mental monsters. Just, you can't find a flaw in these guys. So I'm sticking with those dudes. And I don't know if you asked me for something else, but yeah. And then Buffon in goalkeeper. So there you go.
No, I was going to say too, your current center back, if you have one that's still playing.
Oh, current. Man, it's good. Man, it sounds like a cop-out because I doubt he's the best, but it's top of mind. I think...
You're in long LA with me. I'm just
fucking... No mames, the center back from Argentina, Cuti Romero, dude.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I don't know. It seems like he has the mentality of like Pepe, you know, the Real Madrid Portuguese center back during his prime, like massive mentality. Ain't nobody fucking with me. Ain't nobody fucking with my teammates. Like that level. He also has quite good technical execution in possession and on the ball. So I don't know, man. And then defensive chops. I'm just hearing from testimonials of pro players who have to go up against him and they don't want to go up against him.
Yeah, for sure. Not for me, Gary, obviously, little bit younger than you, but you know, when I was growing up, it was that dream team of Barca, and Puyol was just the fucking rock in the back line, and just not even like his defensive qualities, but just the way that he, like we talked about earlier, he was like a general, and just watching him command the team and keeping everybody in check, making mean ass tackles, and like he rarely got beat. So for me as a kid seeing that, I was like, wow, you know, this guy has it. And then obviously, I know you mentioned too, but Marcelo, dude, he's just incredible to watch. And even more so than his defensive qualities, just his flair on the ball, his confidence to do things that, you know, not many left backs in the world can do. And like, a badass player, dude. So those are my two guys.
Gotcha. Well, you just said active players. You didn't say about in their prime. Because if we're talking in their prime, also Sergio Ramos is in the list.
Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah, that was a legend, dude. I heard he got a red card so he can attend his wife's birthday, dude.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, dude. Legendary. Promotion relegation, Gary. How does it tie into defending?
The same way it ties into all the other topics, Benny, is there are consequences if you are not the best in there. I'm talking about at the club level, I'm talking about the coaching level, I'm talking about the player level, I'm talking about the scouting level. Everybody has to be at their very best to identify, quote unquote, what they think are the best defenders, be able to acquire. So we're talking about recruiting, right? Who, you know, be able to have, that's a talent. They get the best defenders. You have to be able to train properly. So the coach has to have, or the technical staff has to have, massive chops in doing that. You cannot, as a club, you have to have the capability of identifying who are the best people in those sorts of positions and hire them and recruit them and retain them and enable them. I mean, it all goes down to incentives, Ben. Like, if you suck defensively, if you're at the top of the table, you are not going to win a title, or you are not going to qualify for other international competitions, if we're talking about the pro level. And if you're at the bottom end of the table, guess what? You're going down. You're going to get relegated. And so everybody has to operate at maximum peak efficiency. And at the youth level, the same is true. If there's promotion, relegation, all those things that I just mentioned also apply. Because guess what? You as a youth, we shouldn't even be talking about youth clubs. There shouldn't be youth clubs, Benny. They should just be clubs. The only reason we say youth clubs here is because there is a monopoly at the top. And since there's a monopoly at the top, MLS, you can't have clubs being promoted up to the first division or whatever division it is. So a natural byproduct of that is that soccer businesses here are created with just youth in mind, because you can't operate at the professional level. You're not allowed to operate at the professional level. There's no incentive to operate at the professional level. So guess what? We create youth clubs, youth only clubs. But even if there was youth promotion relegation at the youth level, everybody's going to try to get promoted and not be relegated. And half of the equation is the defensive side of the equation.
Now, do you think about the last game of the season and you only have to tie to not get relegated, or you only have to tie to not get promoted? You're fucking defending for your life, dude.
And guess what? With that pressure, the players get better too, because there are consequences, and they all know there are consequences. Right now, it doesn't matter. Oh, we're in last place still. Do we want to be second to last place, like, as a consequence of the result of this game? Nah, sure, but it doesn't really matter. So do you think your center backs and your outside backs are going to die on the field, you know, to get that one point that they need? They're not going to die. They're not going to die on the field, Ben.
Yeah.
Do you think the parents would not take that vacation, or, you know what I mean? Or you think that, rather, they would take that vacation on the last day of the season? Because if they take that vacation, the center back's going to be missing, or the outside back's going to be missing, and then the team's going to get relegated, you know, or the probability of getting relegated is higher, or the probability of getting promoted goes down, right? If the family goes on vacation, the family's going to be there. The kid's going to be there. And the parents are going to be like, this needs to be the best game of your life.
Right. Yeah, dude. Well, even Gary, it's like, especially in MLS, it's not like you're talking about that last game being in last place. It's not even about like the players trying hard. Like, if a club is already not qualified for the playoffs and they're not going to make it, I mean, they're probably not even playing their starters anymore. They're shocking players that haven't got minutes, or the players that, hey, you're a youth player, come on, come play for the first team. So it's like, what even is this, dude?
No, it's crazy, Benny. It's crazy. The incentives are all effed up, dude. Hey, remember the last episode that we said, we gave the example of like the Galaxy, and I give the example of the Galaxy, obviously, because I'm here in Southern California. It's the closest thing, and it's the only example that we can give that's timely from last season to this season. Last season, they won MLS Cup. And what did I predict? What did I say was going to happen? Oh, the subsequent season, there's absolutely no pressure at all. It doesn't matter. You know, they don't have to win it again. You know, they already achieved that. So they bought themselves many years of not having any pressure from the fan base, from anybody, because they already won it. And so this year, I think they're dead last, Ben, if I'm not mistaken, like dead last in the table.
Yeah,
after like seven or eight games.
Huh? I don't think they've even won a game, Gary. Let me see.
And it doesn't matter. So now you can play politics and even more so in optics, more so, oh, let's give the young players maybe some opportunities, you know, throw in some homegrowns in there. So, oh, fucking, the whole thing's fucking retarded, Ben.
Yeah. No, it's crazy, dude. And yeah, right now they're 5 losses, 2 draws. The funny thing though, Gary, is like you said, they won last year. Like, okay, a couple of weeks from now, they're having like replica championship ring night. And so even though the team hasn't won a game, the stadium's going to be fucking full, dude.
And you know how stupid this quote unquote fake competition is? It's this stupid. Let me tell you, it's still possible for them to make the playoffs.
Oh, yeah.
They're 0 wins, 2 draws, and 5 losses. They have 2 points in 7 games. I don't know, by the time, you know, the 30th game comes around, they might be right there close to making the playoffs or in the playoff zone, and they might make the playoffs. And, you know, in the playoffs, it's a coin flip. Anybody can beat anybody on any given day. And maybe they even make a deep run, you know, in the playoffs, and all is good. No pasa nada. This is not a competition, Benny. Could you imagine Real Madrid wins La Liga and then, oh, well, we won it last year. So, you know, it's fine. We can do whatever we want now. It's all good. And they're dead last place in La Liga after 7 fixtures. Like, what on what planet is this a good thing to have these sorts of incentives?
There'll be riots in Madrid, dudes.
No, and you see it with the fan base here. The fan base, you think there are any riots happening? No, I'm not. And I'm not inciting to riots, but riots is a euphemism for how the degree of how upset are you as a supporter, as a fan base? And they're not upset. Nobody's upset. Nobody cares. It's okay. It's fucking, it's shocking, Benny. It's shocking. I saw there was a comment from our last episode that was about, you know, me giving you a hard time for actually paying money to go and watch like a LAFC match or something like that. And they're like, oh, what do you say? You said something like, oh, the hate is real. Like, Benny and I are just soccer people. We want to go see soccer. And I'm like, that's fine. I'm just saying, this is what you're supporting with your money, is this sort of behavior.
Yep. Well, dude, I mean,
you're signaling with your wallet. You do what you want, obviously, but you're signaling with your wallet, which is what matters. You know, you're signaling with your wallet that, oh, how you guys do things, it's okay. Carry on.
Yep. Sucks, but I mean, No comment, dude.
But Ben, look, you are a practitioner. You know what I'm saying? You are a practitioner in the field. So, for instance, I've been watching MLS and operating the ecosystem since 1996. And to this day, I'm still engaged and involved in the ecosystem. So in many respects, I'm still supporting it. Even by the mere fact of me speaking about them, I'm kind of supporting the system because I'm giving it attention, but I have to. It is part of the job.
No, I feel.
But if you're just a straight up fan, if you're just a straight up soccer fan, or so, like if you knew the things that were going on, you would not open up your wallet and support this stuff.
You say you don't want to go to a replica ring night with me, dude?
This is so crazy, Ben. It's, look, and I said it a million times, and people say, "Oh, the hate is real." I don't hate. Like, if I were MLS, I would probably do the same thing. What business does not want to have a monopoly? I want to have a monopoly. It'd be awesome. If 343, if US soccer or the president of the United States, whoever, said the only allowed training, education in soccer is 343 and nobody else, I'm like, well, okay, I'll take it. Fuck it. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Okay. Cool. So I don't hate them for operating the way that they do. Do I think they do nefarious things and evil things and bad things? Yes. But those are I'll tell you where my hate lies. My hate lies with the fucking quote unquote people masquerading as journalists, because you are supposed to be telling these truths. It shouldn't come down to the actual practitioners, the people trying to build something in the space, to put their neck out on the line to tell the truth. That is your fucking job. That is why you are there. You are supposed to be informing the public of what's actually going on in the ecosystem. And you don't do it. You actually side with the monopoly. You side with the people in power. You craft narratives and perpetuate lies, and they could be just lies by omission, in order to uphold the establishment and the status quo. You're doing the exact opposite of what a journalist should be doing. That is who I have the beef with.
All right, next podcast guest, we got a journalist out here, MLS journalist.
Is there such a thing? I don't know if there is such a thing, Ben.
Yeah, sure.
All right, dude.
All right, brother. You're getting too worked up, dude. You know, once your eye to get all fucked up again.
Well, this is good. I don't know. Maybe folks are like, oh yeah, Benny, try and find a way to get this guy worked up more often. This is what we came here for.
Yeah, people like it, dude. People like it. All right, brother. Good stuff.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches. You can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football, while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.